From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
It was almost 30 years ago. The Great War had ended, and the tourists had come back to Baker Street to catch a glimpse of the real Sherlock Holmes.
Today, Ian McKellen. He plays a 93-year-old retired Sherlock Holmes in the new film Mr. Holmes. Although McKellen is an acclaimed and knighted British stage actor, he's probably best known in the U.S. for playing Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings and Hobbit films. Last month, he was a Grand Marshal at New York City's Gay Pride March.
Once I came out, once there were no restrictions on being myself, acting for me changed from being about disguise and came to be about revelation, about telling the truth. My closest friends said, well, you become a better actor.
Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Garnett Mims, one of the early voices of soul who had the hit Cry Baby. Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another NPR podcast about pop culture you might want to check out. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. He interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and others about their work and their lives. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, British actor Ian McKellen, is probably best known to American audiences as the wizard Gandalf in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings films, a role that earned him one of his two Oscar nominations. But he's been acting in film, theater, and television for more than 50 years and is so highly regarded in England that he was knighted in 1991. Among his other films are Scandal, Six Degrees of Separation, Richard III, Gods and Monsters, and three X-Men films. McKellen, who came out in 1988, has been a prominent gay rights activist in the UK and was co-grand marshal of this year's Gay Pride March in New York. Ian McKellen spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies about his career and his latest movie, in which he plays an aging Sherlock Holmes. In the film, called Mr. Holmes, the famous detective is 93 and living on a seaside farm when events prompt him to try and remember his last case, one that made him retire from the profession years earlier. In this scene, McKellen, as Mr. Holmes, is visiting Japan and having lunch with a man whose mother pours tea and asks about some signature elements of his popular image, such as the large hat called a deerstalker that he was known to wear in Sherlock Holmes films and illustrations.
You are a very great detective.
Thank you very much.
My mother, she wonders if you have brought your famous hat.
Oh, the deerstalker. That was an embellishment of the illustrator. I've never worn one.
And a pipe?
I prefer a cigar. I told Watson, if I ever write a story myself, it will be to correct the myriad misconceptions created by his imaginative license.
And that is Ian McKellen in the film Mr. Holmes. Ian McKellen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much indeed.
You know, one of the things that I noticed right away in the film was how completely convincingly you captured someone who is 93. I mean, the breathing, the pitch of the voice. Do you want to talk a little bit about preparing physically to deliver that?
Well, I've been preparing all my life because I'm now 76 years old, so I'm closer to 93 than I've ever been before. It's acting, you know. It's imagining. It's exaggerating feelings that of mortality that we all have. But I've had aches and pains that just niggle and affect the tone of my voice, and so I just imagine that I've gotten more physical inconveniences, and then it all seems to work. If you get the look of a character right, it seems to me, it feels to me, you probably, having got the face right, you've got the hands right too, that somehow using your imagination, nothing special about an actor's imagination except that he uses it a lot. If you're sounding right, you're probably walking right, and vice versa, if you get the footwork right. If you get even one line right in a rehearsal, a director will say, do you know, when you said that, it was exactly the character. You were really landed on it. Oh, I see. Yes, and if you're able to repeat what it felt like when you were doing that, whatever it was that was right, line, gesture, move, tilt of the head, then you can say, ah, yes, I can feel that. Now I'll put that into the way I walk, the way I move, the way I sit, the way I get up, the way I speak.
I want to play another scene from Mr. Holmes, and this is early in the film when you, as the aging Sherlock Holmes, has returned from Japan, and you've realized, yes, using your powers of investigation, that someone has been into your study while you're away, and you confront the young boy Roger, who lives on the farm where you keep your bees. Roger is played by Milo Parker, and you confront him. I'm just going to mention two things about the scene. One is we will hear the kid refer to Sherlock Holmes' amazing ability of perception and analyzing detail. And again, I'm just going to note the remarkable things, the difference between the voice that we're hearing of you now and the voice we hear of the 93-year-old Holmes. Let's listen.
Okay.
Why did you do it?
Sir?
Break into my study. My study is my sanctum sanctorum. Private place.
Before you went to Japan, I saw you writing that story. I didn't know you wrote stories.
Oh, Dr. Watson, yes, he was the writer.
Well, so I borrowed Mum's key and went into your study, and there it was.
And how much did you read?
Just where you stopped. It was a good part, too. A man comes to Baker Street, you say you've come about your wife. How could you tell? Did you do the thing?
What thing would that be?
The cane shows the marks of a dog's teeth. The wood is from an island southwest of Madeira. That thing.
And how would you tell that a man's visit was about his wife?
He wears a wedding ring?
Well, the clues are all on that page. This sentence, to be exact.
One day into the room came a young man in newly pressed, albeit inexpensive, clothes. Clothes are freshly pressed. He's a young man, though, not expensive clothes. Then his wife must press them. Men don't have the talent, and he can't afford a servant to do so.
Very good.
That's how you knew it was about the wife?
Well, no. When you're a detective and a man comes to visit you, it's usually about his wife.
Okay. That is
I love that line. It sort of debunks everything, doesn't it?
Right.
Who needs to be clever? Just I've been a detective for a few years and you get to understand human beings.
Yeah, analyze all the
interesting
details.
Interesting. You should draw attention to the voice there. And it is radio, after all, that we're indulging ourselves on. It's a voice that he doesn't put any energy behind. It doesn't have the energy. But as long as the little boy who's and the microphone, which is just quite close by, there's no need to speak like this, you know, like we might in life and certainly would on stage. So it's fun, and it's just allowing the energy level to drop. I suppose that's what happens as you get older. You don't have spare energy. You can't easily get out of the chair. You can't run. You can't make it to the top of the stairs without groaning, and you can't speak often without getting breathless. It's a miserable business.
No, it's
not for sissies.
Well, you
that
know,
Betty Davis, wasn't it?
You know, I read your father was a lay preacher, and that your grandfathers were preachers, and I wondered if you picked up anything about, I don't know, performance, commanding attention from being around them.
Yeah, my grandfathers. One was a professional, had his own church, Congregational Church, United Reformed, I think you may call it, and the other one was a Baptist, a lay preacher, and he was the great performer, W. H. McKellen. He used to do wide gestures and suddenly point beyond the congregation's heads and say, "I see the children of Israel," and he'd point, and all the heads in the congregation would turn around to see what he was pointing at. Well, of course, there was nothing there. He was acting. I once saw him address a large meeting in Manchester in the north of England, and he was in his 80s, and a bit frail. He was living in our spare bedroom at the time. And he suddenly stopped speaking. And there was a dreadful, dreadful pause as we all realised the old man didn't know quite what to say next. And in his confusion, he just sat down. And, well, 1,000 people buzzed with worry and, ooh, embarrassment. And he sensed that, and he suddenly got out of his seat and said in quite a loud voice, "You know, this is worrying you a lot more than it's bothering me." God bless him. And, you know, that self-confidence of being able to do what not many people can do, which is talk to a room full of strangers off the cuff, is a bit reflected in what I do for a living, except I don't, on the whole, speak off the cuff. But I'm at home in that situation, as he was at home. So I think I may have inherited that. But yeah. the side of the preaching that I eventually surprised myself in wanting to do, because I've never thought of acting as being preaching, although there might be be a message in the story being told. It was when I came out as a gay man and found myself on platforms making a case, pleading with people to understand, shouting on occasion about the certainties of my life which people hadn't understood, that were, I think, reminiscent of what both my grandparents often did. And there are also missionaries in my family, and teachers, a lot of teachers. And these days I go around schools quite a lot talking about what it was like to grow up gay when it was illegal to have sex, and for me. And so I've turned into a teacher as well. And I think it's that side of my life rather than the acting, which is, I feel myself to be part of a tradition.
You recently were the Grand Marshal in the New York City Gay Pride March, along with Derek Jacobi, who is your co-star in the comedy Vicious. And this is not something new to you, I know. But for a lot of years, you were not openly gay, although I read that you revealed yourself to your acting friends for many, many years before the public knew. And it occurred to me that that's probably wouldn't be possible in today's world. And I wondered if back then, did people in the media know and respect your privacy, or was it something that you feared was going to get out?
You know the phrase, to out someone, to tell them against their wishes, perhaps, or without their permission, to announce to the world, define someone's sexuality on their behalf, outing them. There was a phrase invented by, was he called? William Henry, was it the third? He was a critic for Time magazine, I think. He revealed to me just before he died that he was gay himself, although happily married. And he said, it's the dilemma of when you know someone's gay, can you say that about them? Just as you know they dye their hair, can you say that about them? They've got a secret, you know it, they've revealed it to you, maybe. Do you have a responsibility to lie on their behalf? This is the dilemma of outing, and it's not an easy one to solve. But my life up to the point at which I finally came out, and coming out is a bit of a journey you go on, can be short, can be long, as it was in my case, you come out to yourself, as it were, first, and then reveal it to people close by. Mm-hmm. And I, frankly, just responded to the situation that it was at the time I was living. Yes, it was perfectly easy in the British Theatre to be openly gay at work. Nobody gave a damn. Yes, I could live openly with another man and be surrounded by straight and gay friends. No, we could not show any affection in public because we might be accused of causing a breach of the peace if someone took objection to us and threw a stone at us. No, I didn't tell my parents because we didn't talk about important matters of the heart. And no, I didn't talk to the media about it because if I did, I would be identifying myself as a criminal. Because when I started acting, it was against the law for me to have sex. Mm. So, I wasn't very brave. I wasn't really part of the real world. I didn't make the connections with other people who weren't as privileged as I was to live fairly openly as a gay man. And all this only became evident to me when I felt the need to come out to the media, and therefore had to come out to my close blood family, and then my coming out was complete. And that all happened because there was a very bad anti-gay law going through a parliament that I took exception to.
Right, and it made a difference to have someone of your stature coming out and joining that cause.
Yes, I suppose it did. Yes, and I think my main use when I started activating with other people who'd been standing up for themselves and other gay people for much longer than I had, my most valuable contribution was my Filofax, was my addresses, my names of people like myself who were totally sympathetic to changing the laws of the land but had never done anything about it, and I could call them up or say, come on, will you join in? And on the whole, they did.
You know, before you came out, when you were living a life, I mean, you were in public at least having to pretend to be something, perhaps different. And of course, acting is about pretending, but it's also about finding some true part of yourself that relates to the character. I mean, there's has to be an honesty to it for it to be convincing. And I'm wondering whether keeping the secret or eventually shedding it changed you as an actor.
Well, that's very perceptive of you. Yes, absolutely. And if I'd known that, maybe I would have come out earlier on professional grounds. I think one of the reasons that so many actors, at least in the past, have been gay, albeit secretly, is that they are robbed of everybody else's birthright, which is to be themselves and to be honest about their relationships, to celebrate their relationships, to send out wedding invitations, to show pictures of children which confirm heterosexuality. Because as a gay person, well, A, you couldn't get married and you didn't have children, and it was against the law, so you kept quiet. But within the confines of a play or a screenplay, a script, a piece of fiction, you could indulge your emotions, which you weren't allowed to do publicly as an ordinary person. Now, once I came out, once there were no restrictions on being myself, once I could hold hands with somebody I loved in public, once I could draw attention to my feelings, acting for me changed from being about disguise and came to be about revelation, about telling the truth. And so you're right. It's extraordinary, isn't it? I didn't do anything other than coming out, and my closest friends said, well, you've become a better actor. Your acting's better now. And because I'm dealing with the reality of my emotions, not the character's emotions, you see what I mean? So, you won't meet a single gay person who ever regrets coming out, and here's, I'm another one to confirm that, and everything becomes better in your life. Your relationships become better because they're based on honesty. Your self-confidence grows because you're your own person. Why wouldn't you become better at your job? Particularly when that job is dealing with the inner life.
In those days when you were not yet out, did you have any concerns about being cast in a love scene with a woman on film, for example?
I did. And I thought I wouldn't be very good at it because I hadn't had any experience of it. Yes, I was it was a bother to me. I also used to say to myself, not often, but I did, I can't let people know I'm gay, otherwise they won't be able to accept me as being straight in the play or the movie. Well, it's not true. I doesn't worry. I don't care about any actor's private life. Their sexuality is of interest, but the point is the character they're playing convincing? Do I believe them? And, so I think it was just an excuse. and I didn't want to cut myself off from the possibility of playing Macbeth or King Lear or many of the Roncalvania parts that are resolutely straight, and that would be, for me, cutting off my nose to spite my face. However, the first job I took as an actor, after having come out, was to play as resolute a heterosexual as I could find. And that was a disgraced British politician called John Profumo, who in the movie Scandal, mm-hmm. his story is told about how he lied to Parliament about having had an affair with a prostitute, which he inadvertently shared with a Russian spy, so that wouldn't do for a cabinet minister. Anyway, I played this part on film, and my first job was to appear to be having sex with Joanne Wally Kilmer in the marital bed. Well, this would have been a joyful scene for any straight actor to play. She's extremely beautiful and lovely person, and I didn't know what to do with her. So I went to a friend, Edward Petherbridge, the actor, who knows about these things. I said, Edward, I've got to do this love scene. Can you explain to me? Can you just draw me a little diagram? So he did. He gave me some stick figures and
really
showed me what was possible. So I'm now an expert on the missionary position, and everything went well.
I want to talk about Gods and Monsters. This was 1998, for which you earned an Academy Award nomination. It's the fictional story of the last days of James Whale, who was a real person, the British director of the films Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and I think Invisible Man. And
that's right.
In the film, he's living in Hollywood in 1957. He's old. I think he's had a stroke. He's a gay man in Hollywood. Why don't we listen to a clip here? This is you as James Whale speaking with a young journalist who's played by Jack Plotnick, and you insist that the interview be conducted beside your pool. Let's listen.
So, Journey's End brought you to Hollywood.
I've got a little proposal. This line of questioning is getting old,
don't you think? I don't mind.
Well, I do. Let's make it more interesting for me. I will answer truthfully any question that you put to me, and in return, for each answer, you will remove an article of clothing.
That's funny, Mr. Whale.
Yes, it is, isn't it? My life is a game of strip poker. Shall we play?
So the rumors are true, then?
What rumors have those been?
That you were forced to retire because of a sex scandal?
A homosexual scandal, you mean? For me to answer a question of that magnitude, you'll have to remove both your shoes and socks.
You're a dirty old man.
Oh, it is kind of you to indulge your elders in their vices. Just as I indulge the young in theirs.
And that is Jack Plotnick and our guest, Sir Ian McKellen, in the film Gods and Monsters in 1998.
What a good dialogue. That is based on the novel.
Christopher Bram's novel, yeah.
Christopher Bram. Lovely to hear that scene. It's so funny.
Yeah, well, people in the audience who haven't seen it might want to check it out. It's a really rich story and performance. I mean, the more meaningful relationship in the film is between your character and a good-looking young gardener played by Brendan Fraser, who is most emphatically straight and kind of typically homophobic for his day. And yes. Your character, Whale, who no longer directing films, does do drawing, asks the young Brendan Fraser to pose for him, insisting he has no interest in his body. Do you want to talk a little bit about what that relationship is like and what it was like with Brendan Fraser?
Oh, Brendan, well... well, there he was. He was what he appears to be. Brendan looks like that. Stunning figure he had and worked at it hard. He wasn't yet a star. He was about to become a film star. With the release of one of his big movies, we got on terribly well. Canadian theatre background, so we rehearsed together usually without the director. We went through the script together. We noted things and of mutual interest. So when we came to the rather hurried schedule, another cheap movie. That's what independent movies means. Cheap movies.
So you got to shoot it in a hurry.
Exactly, and that can be very good because the spontaneity is inevitable. So he was very, very easy to work with. But we knew, I think, that we were doing something that was might be considered outrageous. I mean, we're telling the story of a man almost uniquely in Hollywood in the 1930s. The most highly paid director of his time was gay and openly gay. Made no bones about it. Absolutely unusual. A gay icon, really. In retrospect, though, he'd be, I think, surprised at that. He just was his own person. Although, interestingly, like a lot of other people, he hadn't been able to become his own person until he reached California. An awful lot of people escaped from somewhere to arrive in California, and knowing that, you know, you can't go any further. Next stop is, well, the Pacific Ocean and China, and who wants to go there? So they're stuck. And maybe they blossom like David Hockney or other gay people, Christopher Isherwood and so on. And so Whale was a real pioneer, although not fighting on anyone's behalf but himself. So we knew that to tell this story, we were one of the first films to take a gay person at his own, as he stood up for himself and was himself, and present him really as an example of what we should all do if we're going to have fulfilling lives. And it was a very gay affair, not that Brendan's gay, but or Lynn Redgrave, but there was Jack Plotnick and me and Bill Condon, many of the designer, the entire support system on the film were lesbian. It was a labor of our love and our self expression, really. And to have Brendan supporting us in that was good.
You had such a terrific acting career, so much of it in theater, done so much Shakespeare, but probably many people are going to know you best for your role as the wizard Gandalf in Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit films. I thought we'd listen to a clip. This is from The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, in which you as Gandalf the wizard arrive at the hut of Bilbo Baggins, who is played by Martin Freeman. Let's listen.
Can I help you?
That remains to be seen. I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure.
An adventure? Now, I don't imagine anyone west of Bree would have much interest in adventures.
Nasty, disturbing, uncomfortable things. Make you late for dinner. Good morning.
To think that I should have lived to be good morning, my Belladonna Took's son, as if I were selling buttons at the door.
Beg your pardon?
You've changed, and not entirely for the better, Bilbo Baggins.
I'm sorry, do I know you?
Well, you know my name, although you don't remember I belong to it. I'm Gandalf. And Gandalf means... me.
Not Gandalf, the wandering wizard who made such excellent fireworks. Old Took used to have them on Midsummer's Eve.
No idea you were still in business.
And where else should I be? Well, I'm pleased to find you remember something about me, even if it's only my fireworks.
And that is our guest, Ian McKellen, with Martin Freeman in The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey.
If you want to understand how film works, music works in the film, listen to it on radio. Wasn't that wonderful,
yes,
the music, Howard Shore's music, coming in and underlining what the audience might have missed, that this conversation is crucial and is the beginning of an adventure, and all that excitement is wonderful.
Yeah. Which you don't hear while you're doing the acting.
Of course not. No,
course.
Nobody tells you. And often enough, of course, it's because the actors haven't done their work properly that the director has to resort to some music that will do it for them.
Well, you know, it's the, you say you hear that actors, when they're figuring out how to portray a new character, they try and find something of that character within themselves.
Yeah.
What part of you is Gandalf the Wizard?
Oh, I think perhaps the man who, when he knows he's right, wants everyone else to accept it and get on with doing what's right themselves. That aspect. But, you know, Gandalf was a rather easy part. I listened to Tolkien reading The Hobbit out loud. What a show-off. If anyone thinks that he wouldn't have enjoyed the movies, I mean, I think that little recording would prove that them wrong, because he clearly likes the idea of his story being theatricalized. But once I listened to that, and then they put the makeup on me, the false nose, the wig, the beard, the wrinkles, and twinkling through all that mask, there he was. And once I'd seen him, poof, that was the end of any problem. And the story, of course, was so strong, the situations were so alive and alert, and on the whole, these characters say exactly what they mean. There isn't a deep subtext that you're having to worry about. It's not Chekhov. It's Tolkien. It's very on the nose, very to the point.
Okay.
And so relatively easy to play.
Maybe easy to get the character, but shooting was a bit of an ordeal. And you were in New Zealand. Was it for a year for the first three films with all of the
I think it
actors?
Was, yes. And then followed up by extra return visits for quite prolonged periods of time, which suited me. I mean, it's no pain to be living in New Zealand, you know. It's a country with not too many people and a plethora of spectacular scenery and landscapes and environments in which you can get lost, and it's thrilling. So, no, there's no pain really involved. You know, in any movie, there's lots of hanging around, and you know, there are plenty of scenes that I'm not in Lord of the Rings, and those are the times when I can go off and have a vacation in New Zealand. So, it...
Did you and a bunch of the other actors come away with shoulder tattoos, identical tattoos?
Yes, and if only this were television, I would happily show it to you, Dave. But it's on my upper arm, my tattoo, and it says 9 in Elvish, 9 members of the Fellowship, of course. But I don't know what the word is, and I can't read it because I can only see it upside down when I look down at it. And from my vantage point, it seems to spell Gucci, and anything less appropriate for Gandalf to have on his arm, I can't imagine.
And do you like having it now? Do you?
I do like having it. I never see it really. I never notice it. Sometimes it's a surprise to see it still there. But it does. It is linked. It does link me to dear people who I don't see enough of. And I remember holding Elijah Wood's hand while he was having it done. It was in a rather tender spot on his body that he wanted his put. And he winced every so often, and I was able to help him through that. Mind you, it's not childbirth, you know. It's a tattoo, and a very small one. But they were dear people. I loved them to bits, and... be allowed into their world. It's so appealing, that.
Mm. I read,
and then we had Christopher Lee, who, the late, alas, Christopher, right. Who playing Saruman, and older than any of us, older than the hills. And at our first meeting over supper in a restaurant that Peter Jackson was providing, Christopher Lee came up to me and said, "I've always thought that I should play Gandalf." Oh, dear.
And you also did the voice of Gandalf for a whole series of video games based on the films. And I just have to ask, were there moments when you're there in a studio with headphones on doing the voice for a video game, thinking, boy, this is what I've come to from the Royal Shakespeare Company of my youth?
You're absolutely right. It goes like this. Because you have to provide the voice for every situation that the non-characters might get into. This way, Legolas. This way, Bilbo. This way, hobbits. This way, everybody. Come quickly, Legolas. Come quickly, Legolas. Come quickly, Legolas. Come quickly. Oh, Jesus. Well, you do all that, but you do it, frankly, for money. I was paid, I think, more for doing that than for the film. Then when we came to do The Hobbit, I thought, ooh, more of those, that lovely money coming from the games that people play. By that time, our producers had bought up the games company, and so in your contract you were told that you would be required to do this games, and if you did, you would be paid a pretty paltry sum. And if you didn't choose to be paid the paltry sum, which I didn't choose to do, somebody else would imitate your voice. So that's what it's come down to. That you don't pay actors for doing their work.
Mm. Well, Sir Ian McKellen, it's been terrific. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
I'm sorry to end on a grouse. I love radio. Thank you, and lovely to be on NPR whenever possible.
Ian McKellen spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. McKellen stars in the new film, Mr. Holmes. Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another NPR podcast about pop culture you might want to check out. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. He interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and others about their work and their lives. Garnett Mims is all but forgotten today, but he was one of the early voices of soul. His records have been long sought by collectors, especially from his glory days on United Artists and Veep Records. Thanks to a new collection of those recordings called Looking for You, rock historian Ed Ward has Mims' story.
Place everywhere I go, oh, all I see is your sweet face. Though my pain keeps on growing, that's one thing you should be knowing.
Anytime you want me,
come on back.
Anytime you want me.
Listening to the way he sings, it's undeniable that Garnett Mims came up in the church and had a gospel career of sorts before hitting the big time. He was born Garrett Mims in 1933 in West Virginia, but everyone called him Garnett for some reason, and after he'd grown up singing next to his mother in church, the Mims family moved to Philadelphia, where he was in several gospel groups that made records. His day job was in the laundry at Temple University, though, and he listened to the radio and heard Jackie Wilson and Sam Cooke there. In the Army, Mims put together an R&B group, the Deltones, and after he mustered out, he formed the Gaynors, a group that included his friend Sam Bell and another future star, Howard Tate. The Gaynors made a record for a Cameo, but the group never caught on, so Garnett and Bell formed the Enchanters with Zola Purnell, and after a few gigs in a club in 1963, they invited producer Jerry Ragavoy to one of their shows, and he was hooked. Ragavoy was in the process of moving to New York to write and produce with Burt Burns, and Ragavoy was so excited about the first song he and Burns wrote that he called Garnett up and told him to bring the Enchanters to New York to cut it. And so a masterpiece was born.
Much more than I. you just don't know why. And when you don't know what to do, you come running.
Ragavoy knew it was a hit. The labels he took it to disagreed. There had never been a record that sounded like it. But finally, United Artists took a chance on it. United Artists was one of the film studios that had recently entered the record business, but their inexperience couldn't hold Crybaby back. It shot to the top of the R&B charts and went to number 4 on the pop charts. Warner Brothers had also started a label, Loma, for black pop music, and the Enchanters went over there to record while Garnett stayed with UA. Ragavoy produced both acts and changed Mim's sound for his first solo record.
Tell me, baby. Tell me you were home in bed. Tell me you were down with the flu. Tell me anything, baby, but don't let me find out that you've been untrue.
This was truly revolutionary, and it was an R&B hit, although the Beatles probably were responsible for not doing as well on the pop charts as it might have. There were only so many slots on it, after all. But Mims kept on hitting the target with the help of great production from Ragavoy and from backup vocals by a group of women, also former gospel singers, who would later make their own records under the name The Sweet Inspirations. One Girl, his next record, didn't do as well as his previous records, but he made up for that with Look Away in the summer of 1964.
All alone, standing here by myself, and my girl is walking right down the street with someone else. There's not a place that I can run in a town this size, so I just better look away.
Look away.
I said I better look away.
Look away.
I said I'd better look away before she sees tears in my eyes.
But something must have gone wrong after that. For 2 years, Garnett made records for UA, and none of them hit. It wasn't the end, though. Out of nowhere, in the spring of 1966, Garnett Mims had another hit.
I let you go. Oh, what a fool I was to hurt you so. But now I know all of the good times, the big city sights. I had enough of the bright party lights. They'll never make up for the long, lonely night. 'Cause I need you.
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 That was it. United Artists started a soul label, Veep, and Mims made some records for them, but to no avail. Eventually, he and United Artists and Jerry Ragavoy parted company, and he recorded for some other labels. Janis Joplin had a hit with a remake of Cry Baby in 1971, and then, in 1977, Mims had a one-shot disco hit with What It Is that did pretty well. In 1978, though, his father died, and Mims went through a personal reevaluation. He returned to the church, and today he's an ordained minister and sings only sacred music.
Ed Ward lives in Austin. The music he played is from a collection of Garnett Mims recordings called Looking for You on Kent Records.
Thank you.
tomorrow on Fresh Air.
I got some good news to tell you.
What?
About me and Chester.
Girl. Woo! I know what it is. You're breaking up with him.
That's a scene from the new film Tangerine about two trans women who are sex workers in L.A. Tomorrow, I'll talk with the director, Sean Baker, and with one of the film's stars, Maya Taylor. Baker discovered Taylor at an LGBT center in L.A. Join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.